In this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast, we talk with Skúli Mogensen, CEO of WOW Air, the low-cost carrier from Iceland. Also, Miami Rick from the Airline Pilot Guy show joins us. Rick gives us his insights on flying the Boeing 777 long-range freighter. We also talk about commercial pilot salaries, pilot training, the Convair F-106 Delta Dart, flying the Falcon 7X at the Reno Air Races, and a lot more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 379 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'm joined by, well, first, Max Trescott. He's a CFI author and a glass cockpit expert. Sometimes we call him Max West. How are you, Max?
And sometimes we call you Max East. Boy, I said Max incorrectly. Can you believe I can't even say my own name correctly?
Sorry.
I'm great. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks. Hope you had a good Thanksgiving. Hope everybody had a great Thanksgiving. And also joining us, I know he did, is Rob Mark. He's a pilot, an aviation journalist, publisher of the Jetwine blog, and, well, a whole lot of other things as well. Hi, Rob.
Good evening to everybody, and I hope they had a good holiday. And it was really funny when you were introducing Max Trescott. You said a glass. I thought you were going to say a man in a glass jar or something like that. It just seemed like where you were headed, and I'm glad you were more professional than that.
All right. We try to keep it – well, actually, we don't, but this time we'll keep it professional.
Yeah, why start now?
That's right.
And we do try to keep the show at least half full, right?
Yeah, there's the glass. All right. Also with us, of course, is Brian Coleman. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Max. Hey, guys. I am back from – Turkey Day, which was absolutely fantastic. On Thursday, I'm going off to Germany, and unfortunately, Hendrik is our listener. Hendrik is bailing on me because I don't know, his job decided to send him to Singapore or someplace like that.
Oh, so, I love Singapore. Oh,
yeah, can you believe it? He chose Singapore over me.
I'd have made that choice in a heartbeat, Brian.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But to get even, though, I have decided in July to go over to England and attend the air show in Farnborough.
Ooh.
So I, of course, have a huge request for the listener audience to go to our website and click on the donate button and help support me in my journey and quest to get over to England, place to stay, lodging, and all of that. And part of the big reason why I'm begging for money at this point is I'm going over and going to meet up with Captain Jeff, Dr. Steph, and our guest tonight, Miami Rick.
That'll be great. And you'll be able to capture a lot of great content for our listeners as well, I'm sure. Maybe we'll have you do like live updates or something.
Yeah, it's entirely possible.
Yes, but there is the one caveat. The only way that Brian's going to get there is for Rick to put him in a cargo box back the airplane. But hey, you know, Brian, whatever you got to do to get there.
Exactly.
But I should talk. We should introduce our guest, I guess.
I think it's time to introduce Rick, our guest, Miami Rick from the Airline Pilot Guy show. Rick is an airline pilot based out of, where else but Miami, Florida. Rick flies for a multinational airline holding company based in Santiago, Chile. And he flies the Boeing 777 long-range freighter, mainly between the Americas and Europe. Now, Rick has been a freight dog for, I guess, about the last 5 years. But before he started moving boxes, he moved passengers. He was flying the Boeing 767-300ER. And, Rick, I guess you did that for, about 6 years, flying passengers?
Yeah, I did. And good evening, everybody. Guys, it's great to be here. Thank you so much for this great invitation. And hello, all the guys and gals out in podcast land. And 767 for 6 years, both seat positions, right seat and left seat, and then the 777 now for about 5 years now. So I've been at the heavy iron for a little while.
One of the things that we're interested in talking to Rick about, of course, is the freight version of flying and what that's like and how that compares to flying passengers around. And so I think we're going to have a really interesting conversation with Rick. We also have another guest, although this one is pre-recorded. We had the opportunity to speak with Skúli Mogensen, who's the CEO of WOW Air. That's the low-cost carrier from Iceland. Now, Max Trescott, Brian Coleman, and myself, we were able to catch Skúli on the phone the other day while he was visiting Florida, I think. He was in Miami, wasn't he, Max D?
He was. He was there with his son for Thanksgiving holiday, so they'd come to soak up some sun. And having spent 2 weeks in Iceland, I can understand why they wanted to come down and soak up some sun.
They must have taken the sun with them because it's all nothing but rain down here now.
They brought their weather with you.
Yes, yeah. All right, so if everyone's ready, we're going to kick off the show this time with the recorded conversation we had with Skúli Mogensen, and then we'll come back and talk about the aviation news before going on to the rest of the show. So first, we'll start with Skúli, and if everyone's ready.
Ready.
Let's do it.
Ready from the West. We have a special guest today on the Airplane Geeks podcast. I'd like to introduce Skúli Mogensen. He's the CEO and majority owner of WOW Airlines, a low-cost carrier that I actually flew to Iceland for vacation back in October. He's a serial entrepreneur with over 20 years of experience in high tech. He's co-founded multiple companies, including Arctic Ventures, a VC firm in Stockholm that invests in high-tech companies in Scandinavia. Iceland Simi, which merged with Vodafone Iceland and is today the second largest telco in Iceland. And he also co-founded Montreal-based Oz Communications, or maybe you say OZ Communications, I'm not sure, which specialize in consumer mobile messaging technology used by Sprint, Verizon, T-Mobile, and other mobile operators. He's also chairman of, and I'll have to ask you this one, Skúli, Chaos Limited, and they actually make animated films, right?
That is correct. We did one 3D animated film a couple of years back.
Super. Well, I saw that in 2011 you were named the Iceland's Businessman of the Year, that you're a triathlete. You participate in triathlons around the world and also enjoy extreme skiing. And then, oh, by the way, in your spare time, you started an airline. That's amazing. Skúli, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Hey, thank you for reaching us from Florida. Are you doing another triathlon? Is that what brings you there?
No, I'm actually here with my son, who will spend the Thanksgiving here, and we'll try to do some fun stuff as well.
Okay, very good. Well, let me ask you, the conventional wisdom would be that one would have to really be crazy to start an airline. Tell us why you started WOW, and what was the market opportunity that you saw?
Who said I wasn't crazy?
Well, we all are. We're in good company here.
Join the club.
So, no, I think in all fairness, I've been traveling probably 50% of my time for the last 20 years, and so experienced a lot of airlines. And one thing that became quite obvious to me was that the low-cost model was becoming extremely successful domestically in North America, domestically in Europe, domestically within Asia. However, they had pretty much zero penetration on long-haul or transatlantic flights. So when I moved back to Iceland a few years back after selling my main technology business to Nokia in 2008, I was looking at various opportunities. And at that time, Iceland Air dominated all flights to and from Iceland and pretty much had a monopoly on those routes. And they are a typical legacy carrier. They've done some things very well, but in general, they have all the what I call syndromes of the legacy carriers and often government backed or at one point of time were government run. So I thought that was an interesting challenge, interesting opportunity, especially looking at how few airlines were really utilizing the technologies available today and monitoring the consumer behavior. And in particular, using and leveraging the internet to reach out to consumers.
Well, you have a huge background in technology, so obviously that's an important competitive tool for you. Tell us some of the ways you're using technology for competitive advantage.
Well, I still love the fact that we are a small team in Iceland doing everything. We have no employees outside of Iceland, and yet we are managing to launch new destinations, new services, and really just utilizing smart PR, aggressive pricing, I think a great website, Google optimization, all the latest social media tools and technologies to reach out and build a brand. And knock on wood, so far so good. We launched our North American flights last spring, and we have enjoyed 90% plus load factors ever since. And I haven't spent a dime on traditional marketing in North America. So I think the model is working, and therefore we are aggressively growing and enhancing our presence in North America for next season, for 2016, having recently announced flights to Toronto, Montreal, Los Angeles, and San Francisco.
Yeah, so it sounds like you're growing rapidly. I had read somewhere that you started with just acquiring Iceland Express as a two-plane operation. Did that make things a little bit easier for getting into the airline business?
No, not really. They were the other carrier in Iceland, and we felt at the time, we didn't buy the whole business. We just took over some obligations towards their customers, and it really did not make a big difference, no.
So tell us about some of the pros and cons of being based out of Keflavik Airport in Iceland. Obviously, that allows you to use short-haul planes across the Atlantic, which I guess most carriers couldn't do.
Yes, absolutely. So we like to say we have a competitive advantage called Iceland because it's hard to replicate. And obviously, we have the international airport there in Keflavik, which is, when you look at a map and you look at the routes, Iceland as a hub makes a lot of sense. So we have shorter legs or routes than if you are, for example, using Gatwick or Dublin or Oslo or some of those destinations as hubs to reroute traffic across Europe. And as you correctly mentioned, this enables us to use narrow-body fleet for the East Coast destinations and pretty much all of Europe. It gives us an advantage in the sense that we can rotate our fleet. So we start in the morning going to Europe, come back in the afternoon. They go to North America and back all within 24 hours. So we have an extremely high fleet utilization, which is key. And so we will continue to expand on that front. Now, with the new LA and San Francisco routes, we are adding the 330s, which same logic by flying into Iceland and then distributing traffic to our destinations in Europe. We think we can lower fares significantly and filling those planes.
And you're planning on doing the same turn with the A330? So it'll do Reykjavik to Los Angeles, Los Angeles and back?
Correct. So due to the stage length, it cannot do this loop within 24 hours. However, we will also get very good mileage out of that aircraft. And yes, we will utilize that on our key routes in Europe. So one of the things that we are seeing, obviously, and it's a trend pretty much everywhere, that a lot of these airports are getting extremely jammed. So that's another reason why bringing on board larger aircrafts. It's just to meet demand on the most popular routes.
And are these going to be new aircraft, or are you getting any used aircraft?
No. So one of the things that we have done is two out of those three 330s will be brand new aircrafts. One is going to be a 2010 model.
Okay. Yeah. Part of the reason why I bring that up as a question is the folks over at Delta have been talking about getting some new Boeing 737s, and apparently they decided recently because of fuel prices to keep their 757s, and that gives them a better price advantage. And there was another story not too long ago where Delta
claims, at least, they were able to buy some 777s for $10 million each. And compared to a new price of, I believe it was $285 million at list price or whatever, there's just a huge difference between what the new plane acquisition price would be versus refurbishing an old plane. And I was just wondering how that model would work with a new airline such as yours.
I think you're bringing up an excellent point, and a very important point for us is that we have been very opportunistic in how we have grown our fleet and our new destinations, in the sense that one of the beauties of selling and marketing and servicing our customers primarily through the internet is that we are in direct contact with our customers up until the very last minute of the sale. So we feel comfortable launching a new route, even if it's 4 months to the first flight, meaning I can do a completely new route, do the announcement, make it available online, and I'm comfortable I will still fill those seats even if it's just 4 months to the first flight. This is very unusual from I think, the legacy carriers who take years in planning their route networks, determining new destinations, preparing the marketing material, customer service points, et cetera, et cetera. This forces them to do their network planning, their fleet management, their fleet planning much further out. And as a result, you know, political scenarios change, economical situations change, et cetera. Whereas what we have done, we have really taken advantage of the opportunities that have arisen, such as with these 330s now. We were getting them, I think, at you know, very favorable terms due to some slack in the market for those particular aircrafts. And as a result, this enabled us to do this launch, which otherwise would not have been possible due to the higher costs associated with brand new aircrafts under normal circumstances.
You had mentioned crowded airport capacities at some locations, and I know that Keflavik seems to be a little crowded at times. I noticed that there's hardly anything going on at, you know, 1 to 3 p.m. in the afternoon, but then it's incredibly busy around 5 p.m. I mean, does it make more sense for you to start doing some longer-haul flights because you're starting to have, you know, gate capacity issues at Keflavik? And why is there that funny imbalance to, you know, the usage of the airport?
I think it's due to, again, the rotation that I was talking about earlier, that when we start a new route, it's critical that it matches our European network so that our European customers, as they come into Keflavik, that the North American departures can be you know, subsequently after the European arrivals, and then vice versa. You know, they need to arrive in Keflavik just before the European departures. So we are very dependent on that whole cycle being run smoothly. And this is another reason why we really favor new aircrafts. It's critical for us to have the on-time performance and the reliability that you can't really get from an older fleet. Of course, they, you know, I'm not saying they're not safe or anything like that, clearly, and if well maintained, you know, they are fully capable of flying for 25 years. But there are minor issues that will come up. And when you have a very tight schedule, those can become very, very expensive very quickly.
Do you have those aircraft on lease or have you purchased them?
So we have currently purchased two new 321s. The rest of the fleet is on lease. I expect to purchase additional 321s in the near future.
Tell us about the call signs. We saw one that ends in mom and one that ends in dad. What's the story behind that?
Well, we like to think we're one big happy family, and like everything else we do, we do it with a smile, and we have really emphasized the friendly atmosphere, the friendly culture, both within the company, as well as how we appear towards our customers. And we thought, you know, the naming of the aircraft and our TF Mom, TF Dad, We also have a TF Bro and TF Sis. We have TF Wow. And we will continue along those lines, and you'll see some new, great, fun signatures in the spring.
So that's fantastic.
Can we suggest one for you? I was thinking of TF-Max.
Yeah. Could well be. Could well be. Any suggestions are appreciated.
You know, I've noticed that most of the low-cost carriers tend to be regional. We think of Ryanair in Europe. We think of, you know, Southwest and other carriers here in the U.S. You're going after the transatlantic market. Does that require a different strategy for being a low-cost carrier across the Atlantic versus in a region?
So what we are doing, and one of my favorite sayings that I enforce all the time is copy, improve, execute. And what we have been doing during the last couple of years is to study those regional airlines that you mentioned as much as we possibly can. Study the consumer behavior, how people today are comfortable going online, do their own booking. They go on, they check on a couple of websites to find the lowest fare. And it's very interesting, regardless of what all the marketing jargon you will hear. In the end, the buying decision is based on price. So 80% of consumers will, at the end of the day, choose price over anything else. There is one other very important factor that is coming up because it becomes so readily available. Most consumers will also go on a type TripAdvisor and see the rating of the airline or rating of the service. And this relates to price. So if your rating is not good, your price has to be so much more cheaper than if your rating on TripAdvisor is also good. So that's why we have, again, this friendly atmosphere, the friendly, smiling crew on board. And it's really, it doesn't have to cost a lot, but it does make a big difference. Mm. And I often say the internet is a tough boss. You know, you can't get away with a terrible service for very long because you have a brutal, brutal online community that will convey this message very rapidly. So to bring that on to answer your question, we think that even if low-cost long-haul has failed in the past, it's been partially because the consumer wasn't ready, the internet behavior wasn't ready, the distribution channel wasn't really ready. You were still dependent on more traditional agency or GDS distribution channels. Whereas now, again, the low-cost model has been so successful domestically or regionally, and what we have seen is the same applies. If you can bring a decent service for a very attractive price, why wouldn't it work local or long haul as well?
Yeah, I was going to say that really ties into the question I was going to ask over expanding into the California market with Los Angeles and San Francisco. There has to be something else besides just a low price that's going to bring the passengers to your airline. But what are you doing for the business traveler, especially where frequent flyer programs seem to play so much into the purchase decision?
We have been capturing far more business traffic than I originally anticipated. And when speaking to these businesses, it's often the small, medium-sized business where the owner or the entrepreneur is still involved, where the buying decision, again, is driven by price. Of course, it needs to be convenient and all that. But, you know, we currently live in such a competitive world that any business needs to be, you know, cost-centric. And travel can really become a huge item for a lot of small businesses because it can become very costly. So we see a lot of business behavior being driven in the same fashion where, if you're going to travel on the hand of a company, you are expected to go online. You are expected to do a search and really find the lowest price possible. And that's where we come up.
So looking 5-10 years down the road, what kind of share of the North Atlantic do you think you'll have? And how many planes would we expect to see with the WOW logo on them?
I think that the transatlantic market will, in the coming years, and probably faster than many anticipate, will have a 20-30% penetrated by the low-cost carriers. Mm. And I certainly hope to be having a significant portion of that. And we view ourselves as being the leader. We're at the forefront of driving that change. So we expect to continue to grow significantly. Now, I don't want to give any exact number, but I can say that we are more than doubling our capacity for next year. We'll continue to grow aggressively for 2017 based on plans that are already in place. So when you grow 50 to 100% year over year, as we have done from the beginning, the numbers become quite big, quite fast.
And is any of that going to include South America, Africa, Middle East, Asia, or are you really planning on sticking to the North Atlantic route because of your hub in Iceland?
So that's something that I'm very what should I say, fascinated by. Iceland is geographically perfectly situated to really become Dubai of the North, if you like. And so Dubai is currently connecting Asia, Europe, and Africa. And you can certainly add Asia to the mix. The North and or Mid-South America could fit into that mix as well. So yes, I think there are many opportunities to continue to expand and continue to grow. But I also think that the WOW brand and what we have now done, and again, what fascinates me is that, you know, a relatively small team, but very strong team and technology savvy team can build and expand this business out of Iceland. So in the future, could we have another hub outside of Iceland that has nothing to do with Iceland? Absolutely. And I think from a business point of view, we could still run it and leverage all the technologies, all the Google optimization, the website, the mobile app, etc., could be leveraged completely. The brand could be leveraged. And what could make sense is to use the seasonality, and currently the traffic during the summer months is stronger. So as we grow the fleet, we will have some excess capacity in the winter. And I would love to find a new hub where we could utilize that.
Hmm. Let's talk about Iceland, since you know, that's so central to your operation. I've read that about 20% of your customers actually stop in Iceland and stay there. They don't continue on to Europe, and certainly that's what I did for vacation. For folks who haven't been to Iceland before, what would you tell them about you know, why they should come there for a vacation?
Oh, there are so many reasons. But ultimately, I think it's all about the nature. And whether it's in the summer time and enjoy the long nights or in the winter, if you like nature, if you like the outsides, Iceland is just a one-of-a-kind experience. And it only takes you, you know, 40 minutes to drive outside of Reykjavik, and you're in the middle of nowhere. And I think that's what becoming one of the coolest attractions is, just the genuine feeling that you are one with nature. And in this world of excess connectivity, technology, constant noise and crowds, this sense of complete freedom and is really liberating and unique. Mm. And of course the landscape with the geysers, the ocean, the mountains, the rivers, the waterfalls, glaciers, etc., volcanoes. It is a very unique place.
It is beautiful. Now, for cyclists around the world, tell them a little bit about WOW Cyclothon, because they might be interested in coming in for that.
So there you really hit on one of my key hobbies. So one of the things that we did when we started WOW was to also start this competition where we are raising money for a good cause every year. It started out as a small idea where we race 1,332 kilometers around Iceland in one go. And when we started, people thought we were crazy to actually bring this up. We do this in the end of June every year when you have the highest amount of daylight and the sun really never sets. So you can do this as a solo cyclist, a team of four or a team of 10. And it only takes roughly 40 hours, between 40 and 50 hours. So it's very doable within basically two days. And it's just a brilliant combination of comradeship, personal, you know, activity or focus and endurance with some great fun for a good cause. So It's doubled, more than doubled every year. And this year we had over 1,000 participants. And I think we will probably be 1,500, 1,600 participants this year. So I would love to see you in Iceland.
I'd love to come back. Tell me about you raised money today, this past year. What was it for? A hospital which was building an activity center, I think, for mental health?
Exactly. So it was for disabled children with various disablement. And the logic there really is there's such a connection between physical health and mental health. And after looking at a couple of causes, I was fascinated by how it seems that if you can get people more active, it will have a great impact also on their mental health. So that was really the driver. And one of the participants is an amazing and very enthusiastic individual who has done wonders with a number of kids around Iceland. These were overweight children who had been going through all kinds of programs repeatedly without any success. He got them on a bike, and everyone thought that his mission was impossible, including the parents of many of these children who hadn't even biked 1 mile before in their lives. And he managed to bring, I think he brought 40 children around the country. And it was just incredible to see the enthusiasm and the reaction and the sense of achievement that these children received as a result of it. And I really think he and we managed to make a difference there. So that was fantastic.
Wow, that's incredible.
It is. You're doing such amazing things under the WOW brand. And I just have to ask, since you're going to serve San Francisco, which is my neck of the woods here, are you going to look at the primary airports or some of the smaller, perhaps less expensive airports, San Jose, Oakland, things like that?
It will be announced shortly. So
okay.
You have to bear with me for a couple of weeks more.
But I can book my tickets for June for the race, though, right?
Definitely. Yeah, I was going to say, is the same true for Los Angeles, or have you decided on LAX?
It's going to be LAX. I think that's in the open.
Any other things you'd like to share with our listeners here before we wrap things up?
No, I'm happy to have the opportunity, and we're just very excited about the feedback that we received. And so far, so good. So we look forward to continue expanding in North America.
And tell me, where will people find your website if they're interested in booking on WOW Airlines?
WOWair.com.
Thank you so much, Skúli Mogensen. We appreciate the time you spent with us today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Max and Brian, you probably had the same impression I had, which is he's an interesting guy, and he's running his airline in a way that's quite a bit different from what we see from others, especially other low-cost carriers.
You know, the thing I was struck about afterwards, this didn't come to me till a day or so later, I think in some ways he may be kind of another Branson. He talked about, using the WOW name as kind of a brand for other kinds of things. So I think he has really big plans for this airline. I think they're going to really become a major force over the transatlantic. But I think he may go beyond, just an airline.
Well, and I think what I found really interesting about him is he's not an airline guy running an airline. He's a technologist running an airline, and he's a really, really sharp guy. And I just think that combination, he's definitely set to really do some good things and really be successful in this.
And I think if you look at the WOW Air website, it really has a different kind of a feel to it. At least for me, I found it to be a lot more engaging, a lot more, I don't know, just the kind of company that I want to give my business to, that sort of a feel to it.
It was friendly.
And I thought very engaging. So I think these guys have, they're on to something, and I think they're going to be very successful.
Well, we should mention also that he thought that perhaps he could be looking at Iceland as the Dubai of the North. that was pretty clever.
That was great.
Well, and such a pretty country, too. I mean, it's a great destination in of itself, besides being a nice hub.
Everybody I've ever talked to who's been to Iceland just raves about it as a beautiful place, a great destination, a great holiday spot.
And if you're not into really long legs, as in flight legs, as opposed to the kind Rob immediately thought of, it's a great way to break up the flight as well.
All right. Well, guys, let's jump into the aviation news. And
I think we should, because I'm going to completely ignore that comment of Brian's. And Rick, I'd like to apologize for the impression it may have given you that I, as a pilot myself, am rather a shallow person.
Hey, there's nothing wrong with long legs.
Shallow, but not that shallow.
You got to reach those rudder pedals somehow.
All right, first news story. This comes from Bloomberg. United offers pilots 13% raise in bid to find labor peace. Well, reportedly, United Continental Holdings is offering pilots a 13% raise in 2016, followed by a 3% and 2% in the following 2 years. This comes from unidentified sources who are familiar with the negotiations but aren't authorized to speak about them. United announced a tentative contract agreement with its mechanics in October. They're represented by the Teamsters. And the flight attendant contract is still to come. And so what we're looking at here is the pilot contract. This is a pretty healthy sounding raise, 13%.
Yeah, I guess it all depends how many givebacks I had to make previously to get to this point.
Yeah, I agree with Brian. Quite a few from what I remember.
Exactly. In some ways, this may be kind of getting back to where they were.
There's some interesting data in this article about the pay at other airlines. And it kind of brings the United, or would bring the United pilot pay into sort of parity, I guess. The obvious implication is that United pilots are currently earning a lot less than their friends at other airlines.
Yeah, there's certainly multiple things that make up a compensation package, salary being an important one. And I was really curious. So, Miami Rick, these numbers in this article, how do they compare with freight? Are these ballpark the same or completely out of whack?
It kind of works different for us because we are not hourly earners as pilots here in the States are. My contract and the contract for all the pilots in my company, it's negotiated down in Chile. And we are salary-based pilots. So we negotiate the salary with the company. We basically all get paid the same up until the 60th hour flight. And then from that point on, the airline will tag on extra pay for each hour over 60 up to a maximum of 90 hours a month, which is the legal maximum that we can fly. But these are really healthy numbers. For an hourly, kind of system, these guys would definitely not be hurting financially, you know.
But at 90 hours a month, if I'm doing my math correct, that means that you can only fly 1,080 hours a year?
By law down there, the most flight time you can tag on in a year is about 1,000 hours. So, 1,000 hours yearly, 90 or just under 90 hours monthly, and that's kind of how it works for us. Now, our flight schedule the schedulers at my airline, They'll usually give us anywhere between 60 to 75 hours, and they'll try to spread out the flight assignments in such a way that nobody gets more than 75 hours, because over the 60 hour mark, I guess the money that the airline has to pay out to the pilots it's pretty steep, and so they try to make it fair so that no one gets paid more than anybody else, just try to make it as fair as possible.
Rick, because you're paid on a salary basis rather than an hourly basis, we can assume that there's not a union that represents the pilots?
Oh, we have a union down there. Absolutely. Okay. We have a union down there. And actually, our contract is about to be – we're actually renegotiating our contract right now. And our new contract should be, you know, ready at the beginning of next year. And I'm looking forward to that because by the time the contract is renegotiated and that becomes a new contract, then we all get a nice healthy bonus, which is always nice. So looking forward to that.
You know, there were a couple other articles that came out this week, which there was one in Barron's.com and one on TheStreet.com, and the two were virtually kind of identical in what they were saying, which was that 2016 is going to be a really pivotal year for labor at the airlines. They said that labor is now by far the largest component of the cost for the airlines. Fuel has declined so much that we're now in the seventh year of profitability for the industry, which is the longest upcycle in history for the airline industry. And they also mentioned that the last time we had an upcycle in the late 1990s, the operating margins then were about half of what they are now. Apparently, the industry has operating margins of up in the high teens. So they're working on much larger operating profits than they have in the past. All that says that I guess pilots are, not just pilots, but it sounds like all of the different labor unions are looking to get back all the money that they had to give up in the 1990s and kind of catch up. So we may be seeing, airline ticket prices rise if there's a good increase in labor rates in the coming year.
And I think it's only fair, we need to make the career of, becoming an airline pilot an attractive career choice for young and upcoming pilots out there, because you guys and gals know how this works. Right now you have young pilots that are going through the program, through the system, going on to the commuter airlines, making, close to nothing. And that keeps other prospective pilots kind of away from this great profession because of the amount of money, the investment that becoming an airline pilot represents, and then the amount of money that you would get paid initially. And so I think it's good. I think it's only going to help in my personal point of view, it's only going to help the industry.
Rick, what was the path that you took? Where did you start?
Well, straight out of high school, the last 2 years or 3 years in high school, when I was a sophomore, junior, and senior, I was able to start working on my A&P certificates. So by the time I graduated high school, I was just about done with my A&P certificates. I never actually worked as a mechanic, but I got my A&P nonetheless. And then right after high school, I figured, hey, I'd like to fly. That'd be a good idea to fly. I mean, I've always loved airplanes. I grew around to airports. No pilots in my family. But I was, my mom says that I was born with little, with wings. So, after high school, I went up to the old Comair Academy, which when I went there was called the Delta Connection Academy at an airport just north of Orlando called the Sanford International Airport, which is a pretty big airport with charter airlines out of the UK. It's very close to the Orlando attractions up there, so you see a lot of, or at least when I went there, you used to see a lot of 747-300s, A330s, and stuff like that.
And that's the hub for Allegiant, isn't it?
I believe so. Yes,
I think that's where all their flights go into Florida.
And when I went to school back there in the early 2000s, I believe try at trying to get Pan Am off the ground. They used to be based out of there with the old 727-200s. So we used to see those parked around there. But anyway, I went down there. I went through all my ratings and licenses down there. I went from private to instrument, commercial, single, commercial, multi, CFI, II, MEI. And then after I finished all my required coursework down there, I, through a contact of mine, I was able to secure a position at the airline where I work now. But I thought this was going to happen a lot sooner than it actually did. So basically the whole point of going to the school was to get hired on as an instructor at the school and then go on to a commuter airline. But since I had this other deal going, I figured, okay, so I'll, go back to Miami. I'll instruct here. And I did that for a couple of years. I flew a lot of aircraft deliveries all over the states, which was great because I got to fly different kinds of airplanes in different kinds of weather. You know, not only stateside, but also in the Bahamas and northern Mexico and southern Canada and stuff like that. So that was a great experience for a young pilot. And then when they were ready to call me for my airline position down in Chile, I had accumulated close to 1,300 hours, which for a young, you know, 23-year-old pilot was a great deal of experience.
Yeah,
and
sure.
And so they put me in my class. There were 12 pilots. They put 10 of them on the Airbus 320, which was the airplane that I was initially supposed to go to. But because I had, you know, over 1,000 hours, they put me straight up on the 767, which I thought was, wow, really? I'm going to fly the 76 at 23? Well, let's do it. So that's kind of how it happened. I got on to fly the 76 first out of Santiago, and then they moved me to Ecuador, a city down there called Guayaquil, and I was based out of there until about 5 years ago, you know, before I moved to flying cargo, which is what I do now out of Miami.
All right. Well, we're going to talk about that sort of that transition, but let's talk about training a little bit more. And in fact, our next item, which comes from Bloomberg, is about JetBlue and some ideas they have for training. The article is titled JetBlue Shakes Up Pilot Hiring by Training Them from Scratch. And we know that U.S. airlines mostly hire pilots with flight experience, but JetBlue's got this different idea. And they've proposed to the FAA that the airline hire potential commercial pilots and provide them with ab initio training. They call this program Gateway 7. JetBlue wants to start with the trial program, I guess, really, for 100-seat Embraer SAE 190 jet pilots. And then if that works, maybe they'll look to extend it to larger aircraft. I think this is unique. Rob, are you familiar with anybody else that any other airline that takes this kind of an approach?
You mean that takes people from zero time?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure. There are a number of them. I mean, remember our guest from a couple of years ago, Srinan, who's an FO on the 787 now at Singapore. He started out with zero time, and he went through their cadet program. There, I think Emirates has one. Someone else over there in Asia, maybe India somewhere, does. And you know, when I first saw this, I thought, wow, it's about time some U.S. airline has finally figured out that the way to protect their feed is to protect their feed. Mm-hmm. And they had me right up until the point where they said, and the pilots will pay for their training.
That's right.
And they went on to all the other good stuff about all the things it's going to do, but the pilots will pay for their training.
Really?
Yeah.
Hey, with those big raises they're getting, they could afford to pay it off in 15, 18 years. Not a problem.
Yeah. So they kind of lost me on that one because, you know, that let's face it, as we just mentioned, when Rick was talking about the problem with getting people to love this industry is that they say, well, you know, back in the old days, maybe I would take the risk for $35,000 worth of training, knowing I would make terrible money for a couple of years. But now when those costs are probably well up over $100,000, people are saying, nah, I don't think so.
Yeah. And there's kind of a gap in the program as well. I mean, it doesn't say this explicitly, but you could get all of those ratings except the ATP in your first 250 hours. However, there's no way they can put them in the seat of a JetBlue aircraft until they have 1,500 hours or, with some other special kinds of things, 1,000 hours. So there's that gap from 250 to most likely 1,500 hours. You know, people aren't going to pay JetBlue for all those hours. So I'm guessing perhaps they'll cycle those people into
Yeah, but Max, you know what they do is they'll let them fly cargo airplanes. Those guys don't really know how to fly anyway.
Yeah, but that wouldn't be...
Oh, wait, I'm sorry.
We're not really pilots.
I forgot you were... No, I'm just kidding, of course, no. And no, I think you mentioned a little bit of something like that about putting them in some kind of regional, you know, program. And you know, I don't know who that would be with. I don't think they let any details go. But, again, if you're not going to fund the training, then you've lost an opportunity. Because as you know, when I was just chatting with Shrinan yesterday, and as a matter of fact, and he said, you know, they kind of came to me and said that if I took the training from Singapore, I would. He didn't use the word indentured. I mean, because he was getting paid on top of it during, you know, his first couple of years of line flying fairly well. Not great, but fairly well. But, of course, he'd done all the training. And he said they made it look like, you know, I was going to have to work for them. Why would I go anywhere else? Yeah. Talk about employee loyalty. Oh, my
exactly.
Lord.
Exactly. Job
People
security.
Would work anywhere if a company trained them and said, hey, would you stick around for – you know, 8 years after training to help us break the car. Oh, sure. I mean, I can't imagine anybody that wouldn't.
Hmm. It kind of feels like JetBlue really started to go down a really good path and just sort of didn't finish it, didn't really close the deal, you know, in a way that really would have, I think, made a big difference. You know, maybe it's subsidizing the, you know, training costs or sharing the training costs or something like that.
And I'm willing to bet there's more to the story. And I say that because JetBlue has an incredibly good reputation. Hmm. And I can't imagine that they've put together something that just doesn't make sense on the face of it. So yeah, I think we need to get one of those JetBlue folks on the show here sometime to explain it to us.
I'm sure that if what we are talking about right now, you know, if JetBlue really is saying, well, yeah, you guys have to pay for your training. If that is the case, then I'm sure it's just a matter of time before you know, the airlines go, yeah, wait a minute, perhaps we should, you know, have these guys and gals stay on with us. We'll take care of the training. I'm sure there'll be some kind of contract. And, you know, we'll train them our way. We'll bring them up our way. And then, you know, they'll work for us. And then, because as Robert said, I mean, I don't see anybody who would want to say no to that.
It works for the United States military.
All right. Tell us about that, David.
If you get selected to go to the Air Force Academy, you get your college career paid for in entirety with the thing that you have to do a tour of duty before you leave. So it works in the service academies. It works with ROTC, where you're agreeing to a contract that you're going to go. You're going to get something. You're going to give back what you've gotten. So you get an amazing career in university, and suddenly you have, you know, Roger Staubach couldn't go into the NFL until after he completed his military service because he went to the Naval Academy. So, I mean, I don't know why the airlines aren't bright enough to figure out it works.
It's funny you mention him because when my brother graduated from the Naval Academy a couple years ago, we stayed at his house. We actually had a graduation party at his house. At Staubach's house.
At Roger Staubach's house?
Yep, we did.
Nice.
In Annapolis.
Done.
Yep.
Wow.
Good place.
Well, just to close out this story, JetBlue plans to start accepting applications for this program if it goes through, if it's approved by the FAA, I guess. First quarter 2016, begin training in mid 2016. And then their plan is that pilots who complete the program would start out as first officers in 2020. So that's the timeline for Gateway 7. All right. Rick, did you have to undergo any special training when you moved from flying passengers to flying cargo?
Well, not really special training per se. I did move from the 767 to the 777, which let me put it this way. If after flying the 767, if you had a clipboard and you wrote down everything that you would fix on the next model Boeing, basically that's what Boeing did when they came up with the 777. And I hear that the same applies between the 777 and the 787. And so I had to do obviously an initial course for the plane, but as far as specific training, you know, between flying freight and flying passengers, you know, there really isn't a lot to, you know, a lot there. You do, you know, look a little more into
weight and balance. You know,
no, not really, because you know that operations takes care of that. I mean, you know the basics of it, but what you do look into in a little bit more detail is, you know, hazardous materials, how to handle those. emergency drill codes and that kind of stuff. But as far as the actual operation of the aircraft per se, then there really isn't, you know, any difference between flying passengers or cargo. Really, it's essentially the same deal.
Hmm. Are you still doing the same PA announcements?
I do, because I don't want to get rusty at those. So, you know, even if it's a box of you know whatever it is I'm carrying back there, or horses, or pigs, or elephants, which I've carried before as well.
Oh, wow.
I try to keep my PAs on point, because you never know.
Okay, but let's find out the answer to the real question. If you have a cargo of sheep,
yes,
and the sheep poop in the cabin, who cleans that up?
Well, I tell you what, and this is a true story. We've transported pigs, you know, piggies from Canada to Brazil. Apparently, they were going down there, you know, to the beaches to vacation down there. I tell you, you walk into that airplane, and it smells like a circus.
No doubt.
So
hey, wait, Rick, were these really passengers or were they animals?
Yeah. We treated them as passengers. We made them feel special. Right. But before getting on the airplane, we kind of knew that we were going to be flying pigs from Canada down to Brazil. And so before getting on the aircraft, we went up to the operations office in our uniforms, obviously, because we have to show up in uniform to the office. But before going to the aircraft, we went and we all changed out of our uniforms. And we put, you know, just shorts and T-shirts on and comfy shoes. And we basically put our uniforms in, you know, folded up in a trash bag, and then that trash bag inside of another trash bag, and that trash bag inside of another trash bag, you know, to make sure that none of that smell seeps into our uniforms. And we put those away, and we did the entire flight in shorts and tees, because first, the smell at first was, you know, kind of unbearable, but then you kind of get used to it. But then there's the heat. Pigs, they give off so much heat, like body heat, that there's a setting on the 777 called max flow it's one of the modes of the pressurization and air conditioning system. And with max flow and the zone temperature selectors in the max cold position, which should give you between 16 to 18 degrees Celsius, the cabin would not go below 26 degrees Celsius. And this was an 8-hour flight.
Yeah, but that poor pig, come on, that poor pig sitting next to the one inlet, though, he probably froze to death where everyone else.
Hey, I'll personally vouch for Rick, because Hatfield is right around the corner from us, and I go by when I commute during the morning to some of the pigs that go in the pig trucks. And you can smell them about a mile out. So I'll vouch for, in a closed space, I'm sure it's even worse.
It was, and interestingly enough, there's a system on airplanes called the recirculation fans that recirculate. Now, you know, most of the air is recirculated for, one of them is to keep the air relatively clean, you know, on board. And then the other is the other reason why you recirculate air is because that way you're not constantly tapping air from your engines, from your, you know, high pressure compressor section of your engines. You're not constantly tapping that air, which means that you're able to bring down your fuel consumption. Because if you had your recirculation fans off all the time, then you'd be constantly tapping air from your engines, bringing your fuel consumption up, which, you know, for a flight, you know, for a specific 8-hour flight wouldn't really make a difference. But if you operated the aircraft like that consistently, then that would obviously mean that you're spending a lot more money than you should. So for this flight, we had the air conditioning system on max flow, all the zone temperature selectors and full cold, and we actually had the recirculation fans off to try to renew that air as much as possible, because it was pretty interesting. It was an interesting flight.
Now, we had a story a couple of weeks ago about sheep and allegedly the fire alarm or smoke detector went off because of the gases coming out from the sheep. Is there any type of in cockpit sensor that could have been set off by this load you had?
Well, it's just interesting you mentioned that, because we did kind of touch on that on our podcast, the Airline Pilot Guy Show.
Yeah, I sent it in.
Yeah, and the way it works is these sensors sense both particles in the air and certain chemicals in the air, And I know of one specific, really accident that happened down in the old Quito airport, where it was a Fokker 28, an F-28, and they were carrying a load of chickens in the lower cargo hold. And some of these fumes set off one of the detectors, one of the fire detectors below deck. And this happened just as they rolled past V1. And so they decided to reject that takeoff. And as we all know in aviation, you never abort a takeoff after V1 because basically you don't have enough runway to stop. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they went off the end of the runway and the aircraft was a total loss, which is a very sad situation. Nobody was hurt, thankfully. But, you know, it can happen that these kinds of loads can give off, you know, these emissions that would set off these types of detectors.
Well, speaking of pigs, we have an article. This is in the Daily Mail, and this is about airlines that consume the most fuel in transatlantic flights. There's an organization, a think tank, the International Council on Clean Transportation, and they took a look at airlines flying across the Atlantic, looking at fuel consumption and carbon emissions on a per passenger basis. We'll put a link to this article in the show notes, of course, and it makes for some interesting reading. But what they point out is that British Airways fared the worst in the study, Norwegian much better, and the difference being pretty significant, with British Airways using 51% more fuel than Norwegian, again, on a per-passenger basis. But I thought it was kind of interesting from the standpoint of, you know, I don't know if we're comparing apples and oranges here. You know, I don't know if it is really fair to paint a broad brush across all the different airlines that might have different load factors, different cabin densities, different aircraft types, different right.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. You know, what kind of aircraft is you know, BA using versus Norwegian?
Yeah,
an awful lot of 747s.
Right.
Well, exactly.
The big thing with Norwegian, it's the one of the very few low-cost carriers going across the Atlantic. I think someday WOW is going to be competing with them. But clearly, they've got very high-density seating, and so that's why they look so much more efficient on a passenger per fuel, you know, mile basis.
And they're flying 787s.
Exactly, 7.8s, right.
Yeah, which is a little different animal than a 747-400.
Slightly.
Yeah, yeah. Rick, is fuel consumption a concern in your job? Are there certain actions you take or don't take in order to try to minimize fuel consumption, or do you just fly the airplane?
Well, the way it works for airliners, and this is kind of the same both passenger and the freight side of the operation. When you get dispatched to do a flight somewhere, there is a figure on your flight plan called the cost index. And the cost index is a number that you're going to plug into your flight management computer. And that cost index is basically the relationship of the cost of fuel versus the cost to operate the flight. And so right now, fuel being so cheap, really the higher cost is, and for airlines that pay pilots by the hour, the higher cost is, you know, the cost of the crew, both pilots and cabin crew, flight attendants. And so what you want to do is you want to hopefully have the flight last as little as possible. So you have to pay these guys and gals as little as possible. And so your cost index is going to be a higher number. Conversely, when fuel is cheap, then you want your cost index to be a low number because you want to burn less fuel because fuel is the higher cost. 8 times out of 10, it works that way. Now, it doesn't really work that way when you are talking about crossing the pond, because when you cross the pond in your oceanic clearance, you have an assigned Mach number speed that you have to maintain throughout the Atlantic or Pacific crossing. So no matter what the cost of fuel is, no matter what the hourly pay for the crew is, you're going to have to fly this particular number, which is obviously a number that is figured out by the operations branch of your airline, and as close as possible to the, I guess, LD max, which is the most economic number to fly, which for the 767 is anywhere between 0.78 to 0.81, and for the 777 is anywhere between 0.82 to 0.84 Mach.
Well, again, we're speaking with Miami Rick, flies freight on a 777.
I'm sorry, Miami Rick, but that just sounds so bad. I guess it's my Top Gun days. Miami Rick, he flies freight in a 777. I'm sorry, but
I think there's a reference to my kind of flying in that movie, I believe.
Rubber dog, blank. A load of rubber. And ironically, it's a load of rubber dog blank in Hong Kong, who I was on the phone with just before I got started this podcast. But I'm just sorry, but Max, we got to come up with something better. Miami Rick's better than just hauling freight. He's not a freight liner going down I-95.
No, he's a 777 pilot. How's that?
Well, come on. After the answer you just gave, that's the reason why they call him the Rickipedia.
That's right. But Rick, okay, let's talk about the 777.
Okay.
Some pilots focus on piloting the aircraft, flying the aircraft. Well, they all do that. But in addition, some pilots, I think, are more involved than others in terms of understanding all the systems and subsystems of the aircraft they fly. Where do you fall in that spectrum?
I think I've always been a systems guy, and I think it goes back to me. You know, being a mechanic and always looking for the why of how things work. I like sitting up in the flight deck and looking at a particular parameter changing at a specific rate and knowing why that is, or listening to the pneumatic system or the way the air is flowing, and just, you know, being able to perceive the system going from low flow to high flow at a particular altitude and knowing why that is. It's also because I'm also a simulator and check airman on the 75 and 767. And so as such, you need to, you know, be on your game. You need to stay sharp. And if you're going to teach something to somebody, you need to know enough about it so that you're able to pass that knowledge on in the simplest terms possible for you to, you know, make yourself understandable to the other pilot, who might or might not have kind of technical inclination that you might have. So that's kind of where I fall there. Now, also, I'm a huge proponent of manual flying as well. You know, whenever possible, and obviously taking into account that the number one thing in any operation is safety. But I also believe that, as we've talked about in the podcast several times, many times over, is the fact that I believe that pilots need to, you know, get back to flying their aircraft and not relying so much on automation.
Do you follow along the maintenance of the aircraft you fly? Do you kind of get into it to that level? And yeah,
I mean, I don't, you know, it's not like I roll up my sleeves and get.
No, I don't mean perform. Yeah, no, I don't mean perform it. But are you interested in, you know, when the last C check was and, you know, all that sort
absolutely,
of thing?
Absolutely. Before, when you get on the aircraft, the first thing I check is the maintenance logbook, because before I go downstairs and do the walk around, I need to know what I'm looking at. If I go down there without looking at the maintenance book and I see maybe a dent somewhere, or there's speed tape someplace, or there is or something's been stop drilled, I want to know why that is. And if it's not something that's on the maintenance book, it needs to be. You know, you can't just look at something and be like, meh, you know, probably there. So,
you know, that's a really interesting point that you make, Rick. And of course, I didn't spend a lot of years flying for the airlines. Mine time's all BizHav and stuff. But I can remember, you know, flying for companies that, and most of the time we'd have a mechanic that would take care of the airplanes. They'd pull them out, they'd fuel them, and all we would do is the walk around. And I can remember doing just what you said. You'd get in the airplane, you'd look for the log, see what was broken the last time. And I had, the company shall go nameless, but I had one mechanic come up and say, "Hey, why are you doing that?" And I said, because I'm responsible for that. You know, it's part of my job. And they said, don't you trust me? And I said, he said, so you don't, do you? I said, well, no, I didn't. So it's an interesting question, though, because you'll get some people every so often that are like that. But what you want to say is, I don't trust anybody with my life except me.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And you have to, and just as you said, you have to keep in mind that different types of, I guess, deferred items on that logbook have different types of expiration dates. So you have, for example, a type A item, which needs to be fixed within the next flight day, or you have a type B item, which needs to be fixed within the next 3 flight days, a type C item within the next 10 days, a type D item, you know, a lot longer. And so if there is a type C item on there and I look at the date and it's not been fixed, I cannot legally take that plane, because if I take that plane, even though I might take off with a plane legal, but mid-flight somewhere, that particular item, that maintenance item, is going to expire, and I'm going to land somewhere else illegal. And so first is not right. And then second, if I have a spot inspection by anybody, they're going to be like, well, why did you sign for this aircraft knowing that this particular item, I don't care how, you know, insignificant it is, why did you sign for this aircraft knowing that this particular item was going to expire by the time you landed? And then you're going to have a huge blank stare in your face. You know? And yeah, it's your ticket at the end of the day.
Motivated me is, how would I talk my way out of this? And there are a lot of times you go, there'd be no good way to talk your way out of this.
Yeah, Rick, one of the things I've heard you say time and time again is you have to think like a lawyer.
Absolutely, you do. You have to think of it. Because what are you going to tell the panel when they're interrogating you? What is your argument going to be? And it better be a good one. You know, better yet, don't put yourself in a position where you have to talk to a panel.
Rick, one of the things that is of interest, I think, to some of our listeners is the difference between a passenger version and a freighter version of the same aircraft. Those that you're flying, the 777 that you're flying, were those freighter conversions or delivered from Boeing as freighters? And what's the difference between a freighter version and the passenger version?
That's a great, great question. And the 777s that we have, they were built as freighters. The 777 freighter is a really interesting airplane because it's kind of a hybrid. It kind of takes the best from the 777-200 long range and the 777-300 extended range. And what do I mean by that? The 777 freighter has the wing and engines of the 777-300ER. So from wingtip to wingtip, the aircraft is, you know, it's got a greater wingspan than length. You know, from wingtip to wingtip, it's 212 feet 7 inches. And from nose to tail, you have 209 feet 1 inch. So you got greater wingspan than length. There's a very interesting system on the 777-300ER as well that the 777 freighter has. And this is called the semi-levered gear. And what the semi-levered gear is basically this actuator that locks the two front pairs of wheels. And so when the aircraft rotates, that actuator is locked and the entire aircraft pivots on the aft pair of wheels instead of the center pair of wheels where the strut meets the landing gear. And so what that does is that gives you a higher initial angle of attack, which you need on the 777-300ER because it's a longer aircraft. And so you need that for tail clearance. But on the freighter, it's a feature that's there to be able to allow you to take off with a higher gross weight, because at the end of the day, you know what you really care about when flying a freighter aircraft is the amount of cargo that you can take along with you. And so you have little things that you take from the long range version, little things you take from the ER version. The aircraft itself, avionics wise, is exactly the same. If you're standing at the door of a 777-200ER long range or 777-300ER and a 777 freighter, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference, you know, by looking at the flight deck. You know, mostly. If you really knew what you were looking for, there's one little item that could give it away, and that is a button that allows you to put the taxi camera on. one of the either the navigation displays, the inboard screens in front of the pilots, or the lower screen that's called the multifunction display. That screen sits right in front of the throttle quadrant, and that's a 777-300ER feature only. The interesting thing between a freighter and a passenger version of that same plane, though, is the fact that the passenger version of the jet has a very, very sturdy, bulletproof, tamper-resistant door. Guess what we have on the freighter?
A curtain?
Exactly right. We have a curtain. It's very good at keeping, you know, that pesky sunlight out of the supernumerary area, but not very good, you know, in keeping
of keeping the smell out of pigs.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And that's why we as freighter pilots don't usually take you know, family or friends along in our flights, because it's kind of a big deal for us to be able to for the airline to be able to coordinate all the permits and authorizations that the TSA has to give us to be able to carry passengers or people that are not employed directly with the airline.
Are there different security procedures or requirements?
No. I mean, yeah. Out of Miami, we basically park the aircraft right outside the office. We don't park, obviously, where the passenger aircraft park, because we're a cargo operation. And so you do go through security before you jump on the jet here in Miami. You kind of go, I mean, there's security personnel that kind of go through your bags, no x-ray machines, none of that stuff. But you do get a pad down, or, you know, you get one of those metal detection wands waved all over you before you get on the jet. You know, that'd be it. And then when we fly out of, I'm going to use Amsterdam, for example. We go through the crew center, which is where all flight crews and cabin crews enter the, I guess, sterile side of the airport. You go through security there, and in other airports like, Sao Paulo or Rio de Janeiro or Santiago or Buenos Aires or whatever, you basically go through security on, you know, using the crew line as any other flight crew member would. But so, yeah, I mean, there's obviously security involved, because you're entering protected area of an airport facility. So you need to go through security.
Do you guys have the lamb's wool seat covers as just like the passenger pilots?
Oh, no. Ours is a wicker. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, we do. We do. And you know what? Interestingly enough, and I bet you guys didn't know this, the freighter version of the aircraft model usually costs between $1 and $5 million more than the passenger version of that same aircraft. Hmm. So usually the freighter is more expensive. And the reason behind that is because of all the structural
floor
reinforcements, and not only the floor, but the wing to body fairings and other subsystems that need to be there for us to be able to carry cargo. Hmm. So usually the freighter is more expensive.
You're flying GE90 engines on those, are you?
GE90s-110s-115s, which is essentially the same engine. The only thing that changes is a little microchip in the electronic engine controls, and it's the same engine.
Yeah,
that was a trick question. You were supposed to say Pratt & Whitney.
No, I know. Oh,
it's a JT3s.
Yeah, right.
About 17 per side.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. So, from your perspective, do you long for the days of flying passengers, or you just love flying the cargo?
I tell you what, I mean, if I had to choose one, I'd definitely, you know, would choose cargo. I mean, there's a plus side and a minus side to every aspect, you know, of life, you know, and this is no different.
You just don't like dealing with whiny passengers like me.
I tell you, I mean, it's passenger flying is interesting. It's certainly more, I guess, you're more involved in it. It's a lot more formal, I guess, as much as that can be in 2015.
Flying cargo is just so much more laid back. You know, everything is just so much more relaxed. You're not so worried with you know, keeping the itinerary to the second, because at the end of the day, whether the flight departs on time depends on whether the cargo that you're waiting for arrives on time. And so you kind of have to wait for the cargo, whereas when flying passengers, you know, if the connection from Albuquerque didn't make it, you know, tough. And also, yeah, flying passengers, on my 767 days, I remember it was 230 potential disasters back there that sometimes you kind of had to, you know, there's situations that you sometimes had to diffuse. You know, I had passengers pass away. I remember at one time on a flight from Guayaquil to Madrid, I had a lady actually pass away. And then we later found out that she had she'd been a, you know, the reason why she passed away was because she was a drug mule, and one of the things that she was carrying inside kind of ruptured and she OD'd. Yeah. Now, so these are the kind of things that you kind of have to, you know, kind of deal with. I remember another time I've had several instances where I've had, you know, medical emergencies where I've had to deviate to a suitable airport to get the passenger to a hospital, and you know, and then sometimes the weather isn't exactly the you know, optimal for that kind of operation, but you got to get the passenger to a, you know, to a bigger, big-ish city that has an appropriate hospital, because you're not just going to divert to any old little city that has a runway long enough to take you. So there are a lot of things you kind of have to take into account as an airline, as a passenger airline captain, that you don't really have to deal with as a cargo pilot, you know. So they're both great.
Hey, Rick, but now you have to deal with things like lithium ion batteries.
Exactly right. And
right? I mean, you have dangerous cargo that you have to deal with.
Absolutely. And I'm hoping that lithium ion batteries is something that hopefully here in the near future is something that hopefully we'll stop carrying altogether, because and you guys and gals know, I mean, there's been several instances. I can think of three accidents off the top of my head where lithium ion batteries have been the cause. And as I've said many, many times, these kinds of batteries, and every time I have to sign the paperwork for this particular kind of loads, you know, I'm like, oh man, I hope this is not the day, because if you have a fire warning mid-Atlantic because one of these things went off, it's not going to be a happy ending.
Well, Rick, it's been a fascinating conversation. Some really great insights from you. Really appreciate it. Where can folks find more about you? Tell us about the Airline Pilot Guy and any other places online where folks can follow you.
Yeah, so we do our weekly podcast, the Airline Pilot Guy Show. So it's airlinepilotguy.com. You can follow me. I'm on Twitter at @Miami_Rick, and I'm very, very lucky to do the show with two great, great people, Jeff Nielsen, great guy, great professional, and Dr. Steph. Man, she is the best. You know, I'm just really, really lucky and blessed to have them in my life and be able to share this passion with them. So yeah, Miami_Rick, Jeff Nielsen is at Airline Pilot Guy, and Steph Plummer, Dr. Steph, is at Plum Diggity, and we're all on Twitter there. And you can look us up also on airlinepilotguy.com. We're there.
Great. And of course, now with you being on the show, we've had all three of you on. So it's great. There's a lot of crossover in the audiences between the show and yours. And that's great. They're both great listens for people who are passionate about aviation, but they're different, and they have a sort of a different feel to them. So that's why I think a lot of people subscribe to both podcasts.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you guys are true pros. Absolutely. I mean, you can tell.
Thanks. Thank you. You're very kind, because I can say the same about the three of you. So, for
and,
sure.
And except for this episode, we're usually shorter than 3 hours.
Yeah. Maybe except for this episode. That's kind of a
Yeah, ours go a little. Ours are a little, you know, long winded. But as we were, like Max and I were talking before we started recording the episode, by the time we're done, you know, 3 hours and 4 hours go by, and we're like, wow, that didn't really feel like we went for 4 hours, but we did.
Time flies when you're having that much beer.
Okay. or water if it's the night before a flight.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Rick. And now with his airplane of the week, here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian.
Thanks, Max. Sorry I was late, folks, but I was being interviewed for that other podcast we do via Hong Kong. So I apologize for my delay, and I apologize to our guests because I really wanted to be on the show with them. But this week's Aircraft of the Week is dedicated to our friend Glenn Tower down in NZ. He and I were having a Twitter mint. You know, that's an argument on Twitter about the English Electric Lightning. In honor of that discussion, I'm going to talk about the world's greatest interceptor. No, not that ugly dog EE Lightning, but the sleek beauty with the longer range and more payload, the F-106 Delta Dart, or simply known as the 6. The F-106A was a direct descendant of the XF-92 interceptor. The Convair Corporation used designs from Nazi Germany to complete the F-92, which sole prototype was made eventually earning the X designation. The F-92 was to be a point interceptor, a concept the United States Air Force quickly realized was not a correct approach for the continental United States. A point interceptor gets to its target quickly because the target bomber is directly, almost directly overhead. Thus, you get an aircraft like the Spitfire and the Lightning, and they take off, and they get to the enemy as quick as possible. But back to the 6. The F-102, which grew out of the F-92, was to have the Pratt Whitney J-67 and the MA-1 fire control system. Since neither was mature or ready for the deuce in December 1951, the Air Force decided to make an interim solution, the F-102A, and was given the currently available J-57, and eventually the B model would get the J-67 and the MA-1 fire control system. Initially, the F-102 had serious issues to overcome. The J-67 made the aircraft sluggish and had severe transonic issues. Eventually, Convair would area rule the fuselage. The intakes were revised and two large flarings were attached on either side of the engine. The lessons learned from the Deuce would be converted into the F-102B. Ironically, the interim aircraft, which would be produced more than its successor, with 1,000 F-102A and Bs built. The F-102Bs would continue to have engine issues with the J-67, which was license-built Bristol Olympus. By 1955, the Air Force dropped the J-67 for the more powerful Pratt J-75. Since the J-75 was larger than the J-67, the Deuce's 68 feet 4 inches was lengthened to 70 feet 7 inches. The fuselage was area ruled in the design, where the pinch was directly over the delta wing. The wing area was increased and slots were included into the delta wing instead of fences. The final change was the intakes, which were made larger, and variable geometry inlets were improved. The exhaust was also made variable, which allowed a better idle, which was beneficiary to what was the brakes. The United States Air Force finally ordered a pre-production contract in December 1955, 60 years ago this month. 17 more F-102Bs were ordered in April 1956. Eventually, there were so many changes, it was a different airframe, and the Air Force decided to change its designation to the F-106A in June of 1956. First flight took place on Boxing Day 1956, or December 26th for those who are not in the Commonwealth. Initial flight testing was a disaster, and the Air Force almost scrapped the program. Why? It wouldn't achieve its goals. It was too expensive. Where have I heard that before? Something about an F-35? Oh, yeah, never mind. Cooler heads prevailed, and an order for 350 was placed, albeit the original order was 1,000. On May 30th, 1959, the career of the 6 began with the activation of the 539th Fighter Interception Squadron located at McGuire Air Force Base. By the end of 1960, 13 Fighter Interceptor Squadrons were equipped with the 6. deliveries of the 277 and last F-106A was completed on July 20th, 1961. 63 F-106Bs, the two-seater, were also built, making the entire run 340 aircraft. The 6 would not see combat like its brother in the F-102. By 1972, the F-106 were being phased out in favor of the F-15 Eagle. Air National Guard units would take delivery of active-duty aircraft. Eventually, the 6th career would end up 40 miles from where it started, with the New Jersey Air National Guard's 119th Fighter Interceptor Squadron retiring their last three 6s to Armark in Arizona in August of 1988. In spite of having the lowest single-engine aircraft accident record in the United States Air Force, there were 112 A's and 17 B's lost in crashes and or ground fires. That's not only the fires the 6s would succumb to. The Pacer 6 program converted F-106s into FSATs, or full-scale aerial targets, otherwise known as drones. The unmanned 6, or QF-106, would act as targets with their fuel tank pylons instead being replaced with large burner cans on the wings. This allowed the QF to be shot at with heat-seeking missiles more than once before being destroyed. The Pacer 6 program ended on February 20, 1997. NASA over time used various 6s for testing. The NASA November 616 November Alpha was flown at Langley to test the effects of lightning on aircraft. Yes, folks, it flew into lightning storms to be struck. November 607 NA was cut in half for wind tunnel testing. Lastly, Project Eclipse used a QF-106A 59130 to test a prototype reusable launch vehicle. The aircraft would be towed to altitude and then released where the motor would start and climb to orbit. To test the validity of this, the QF was towed by rope by an NC-141A Starlifter. Successful tests ran from December 20, 1997 until February 1998. The most famous F-106A, though, has to be 580787. On February 2, 1970, it entered a spin in which Lieutenant Gary Faust decided was unrecoverable and ejected from the aircraft, around 13,000 feet. The aircraft decided it was going to have none of that crashing stuff. It righted itself and landed in a farmer's field with a perfect belly landing. One Rob Mark and Max Trescott would be proud of, and it was done without caps. The aircraft slowly moved forward in the snow until it ran out of fuel. The boys at McClellan Air Force Base picked up the aircraft, took off the wings by train, sent it to McClellan Air Force Base, and it was restored and returned back to service. It eventually was sent to the 49th Fighter Interceptor Squadron, where it earned the name the Cornfield Bomber. Most people considered it a lucky ship. It was so lucky, it was used as the example of the F-106A at the National Museum of the United States Air Force in Dayton, where you can still see her today. So with that, I think I'll end it with that story. So, Glenn, show me an EE Lightning that can land itself without a pilot. This is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off. And P.S., all hate mail for my English and Commonwealth friends can be directed to rob@airplanegeeks.com.
Oh, thanks, David. That's a great story. I love that story. It's sort of amazing that it's actually true.
It's very true. And they figured it out that he trimmed the airplane so he could eject out of it properly, and the ejection righted the aircraft so it made its nice gentle landing into the cornfield.
Wow.
And David, doesn't that just prove that you really don't need pilots?
It was kind of a drone, wasn't it?
Themselves.
I'm never going to say that.
See, I think the best part would have probably been when he was talking to his commander and he said, "Now, how did you get the airplane to do that?"
Yeah.
And the guy said, "Well, you know, it was just really tough to explain, but you know."
Well, there is another story that goes with it, that the pilot's wingman followed it into the ground so they could locate it. And after it righted itself and it was flying nice, gently things, he shouted to the guy on the radio in his parachute as he's drifting down from third, "Jim, get back in the airplane. Get back in the airplane."
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australian News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 30th of November, 2015. Come in, Steve. Steve, can you hear me?
I can only just hear you, mate, and welcome, folks, to the Australia Desk for, well, what episode is it, Grant? Because I'm on holidays, and I'm in Fiji.
Who cares? It's an episode. And you're in Fiji. I don't want to talk about time. Time is an illusion, especially when you're in Fiji. Everything stops. I should know. I was just there earlier this year.
Yeah, everything is on Fiji time over here, mate, and I can tell you I think they've only just cleaned up all the carnage from when you were here a few weeks ago.
A few months ago, mate, but don't forget the Fiji time, you know, like when the internationals come in, it's the tower responds with Zulu time report. When the locals come in, they give them the local time. And when it's the island aircraft, they say, well, it's Tuesday, mate. It's Tuesday.
Well, there you go, mate. There you go. We better get this done quickly, mate, because I'm not sure how long this Wi-Fi connection is going to last here at this hotel. But yeah, we did fly over here with Virgin Australia, and well, in what ATC Ben describes to me as achievement unlocked, we actually experienced a rejected takeoff at Melbourne. We had to have two shots at it before we got off the ground. That was interesting.
Well, that always makes for a bit of a challenge. You got two goes at the acceleration and the fun, and the you know, N1 going up to 20%, and then all the way up, and things like that. Half your luck.
Yeah, well, I don't think he made it all the way up. He sort of spooled the things up and we started to really get into moving. And then just as quick as he'd spooled it up, he pulled it off again and basically came to a reasonably abrupt halt and took the high-speed exit there off of runway 16 at Melbourne. Don't really know why. Something to do, I think the captain said something to do with traffic separation on the ground or something. We don't really know, but, I mean, it was very well handled by the crew, I'd have to say. It, you know... you know, I got nothing to really complain about. It was quite interesting, actually. But, yeah, we just sort of trundled off and got back in line and took off again and smooth sailing after that. But for any of our, you know, Melbourne-based listeners, I would be curious to know if there's any gossip. Yankee India Yankee was the call sign of was the aircraft, the 737 from Virgin. And, yeah, it was Saturday morning at 10 o'clock. And just, you know, I'm curious as to know just what was going on. Nobody seems to know. I'm sure it wasn't anything major, but, yeah, interesting nonetheless.
Yeah, I've got my sources on the inside trying to find out the info of what happened, but they're not an ops, so I don't know. It could take a little while for the word to percolate back, if at all. But, mate, I'm guessing that that aircraft left a little late, so it may not have contributed to Virgin's topping the punctuality stats for October. they were good in October, but, well, this is November, so maybe they're not going to be top in November.
I don't know. We pushed back at about 20 minutes late, so not too bad. After all, I work in the railways, Grant, so I'm not going to complain about late running. We do it much better than the airlines do. But
oh, yeah. Well, ever since you redefined on time to be plus or minus 20 minutes.
Oh, well, there you go. So, yeah, I don't know. And had we not had to have that little interesting second go at taking off, we probably would have been on time. But, yeah, very good flight across the Pacific, about 5 hours and yeah, it went in a flash, mate. The only other observation I'd have on the flight is that the in-flight entertainment system wasn't working, the streaming Wi-Fi. I had the app ready on my iPad, and, well, lucky I had an iPod full of podcasts to listen to. That's all I can say, mate.
Oh, well, you know, last time I came back from Fiji, Kit was watching everything on the iPad that, or the Android tablet that they gave her up there where we were sitting, and I was just churning through magazines and passing them to the cabin crew to pass through the door to the tech crew. We landed and they were like, oh, thanks, mate. That was great. Steady stream of magazines for them to flip through at cruise.
Oh, there we go. So I'm going to enjoy it here on beautiful Deneru Island here in Fiji for another week or so and then get back into it. But in the meantime, Grant, I think you had one story in the list there that was talking about some more Fokker 100s heading down to Australia from, of all places, Austria.
That's right, mate. As we reported previously, Alliance Airlines here in Australia has started doing their maintenance with an Austrian Technic crowd, a maintenance repair overhaul organization in Austria. They've found that it's cheaper to do it up there rather than here in Australia. And I think, you know, we were wondering, we thought it was a little odd and we weren't sure how it was working out, but I think we're seeing a bit of a linkage coming through from it in that Lufthansa's subsidiary, Austrian Airlines, that's Australian, not Australian Airlines, it's Austrian Airlines, are going to offload their 21 Fokker 100 and Fokker 70 aircraft to Alliance. And in fact, in the deal, Lufthansa becomes a shareholder in Alliance through Austrian, the Austrian are going to take a, I believe it's about a 12% stake in Alliance. So this is pretty interesting.
It's really interesting and good for Alliance too, because not only are they getting financial backing, but they're getting some, you know, basically a new fleet of aircraft, or maybe not new, but newer, and that can't be a bad thing.
Yeah. No, I think it's all pretty good. Basically, I believe Austrian are offloading them to go for E-jets from Embraer. And, yeah, we're going to see extra Fokker 100s. And Alliance currently operates 15 of them and 8 Fokker 70s. They've got 5 Fokker 50s, which are the turboprops, and they're in the process of getting rid of them, as we reported previously. But, yeah, I think this is going to be pretty interesting. We've got a whole lot of Fokkers coming down here.
Absolutely, and I tell you what, mate, we keep talking about the mining boom coming off and smaller airlines like Alliance doing a lot of work up into those areas for the mining operations. Well, it says something positive about that airline, I think, when they can still be doing this and getting financial backing from a major European airline, and despite the downturn in the mining boom. So they must be doing something right. So that's a good news story for aviation.
Indeed, mate, indeed. I think what you'll find is that Alliance may be getting rid of some of their older ones. They may be breaking up a few of Austrian's older ones for parts to keep their ones running. But again, that'll all be sorted out by Austrian Technik Bratislava, which is the MRO that they're dealing with. So, yeah, we'll see how that all comes out. But I suspect it'll be keeping Alliance's Fokkers in the air for a lot longer than expected. They're talking about at least another 10 years.
Yeah. Now, Grant, I'm sitting here in Denaru Island in Fiji. You want to know what the best part is about the hotel I'm staying in, of course, is that it's right near the airport. So we're right under the flight path. There's ATRs flying over here from Fiji Airways semi-regularly. I mean, it's not a busy part of the world, but, you know, it's still fun to look at from my point of view.
Yeah, well, that would be the ones. They're actually operated by Fiji Link, kind of like you have Cobban and co on. There's the smaller sub-airlines operating under Qantas Link. So it looks like it's Qantas, but it's actually operated by another airline. Same with Fiji Link. They're operating the ATR 72s, 42s, and the Twin Otters with the Fiji Airways paint schemes on them. So, yeah, mate, that's a pretty good spot. Where I was on an island further out from the mainland. And, yeah, by the time we saw most of those aircraft, they were a lot higher. In fact, I was mostly seeing them on Flight Radar 24 when they were going overhead at many thousands of feet.
There you go, mate. Well, my only question here was, well, you know, so beautiful here, do I have to come home?
Well, that's up to you, your missus, and the bank manager.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's mainly up to the bank manager, mate. So in that case, I'll be back next week. Until then, I'm Steve Vischer reporting from Fiji.
And I'm Grant McCarran, where today it's been probably about as hot as Fiji, but nowhere near as much fun.
Cheers, folks.
Wow, thanks. I wish I was in Fiji, boy.
Yeah, but how much water can you carry back? I mean, come on.
Yeah, I know.
Well, let's go find out.
Flight trip.
Yeah, it had to be a flight trip. I just brought up Google Maps and tried to see if it would navigate from Hartford to Fiji, and it said it couldn't find a route, but I'm sure there must be a good one. All right. Well, speaking of traveling, Rob, you have a recording for us, interview that you conducted, I believe.
It was kind of a fun one, actually. One of the magazines I work for, P1 magazine out of the UK, P1, the digit one. That's always a problem. P1-mag.com. You guys might like it. It's only available on the net or to be read on an iPad or an Android device or a Kindle or a Windows tablet or something like that. But what they do is they take advantage of the new technology, and they can embed all the stories with podcasts and videos. And I've been lucky enough to be involved in a couple of those. And I happened to have a chance to interview a couple of Dassault pilots that were flying the 7X at the Reno Air Races sort of during the intermission not long ago. I think, let's see, when was Reno? Was that September, I think, they were there?
Mm.
I'll have to remember that. Maybe you guys remember. But so, you know, they bring the airplanes out to try to show them to people, and it's a great marketing tool. And but it was kind of an interesting story, the way they figured out, you know, they don't just get in the airplane and fly by and go, yeah, there we go, guys, and wave. And so I thought it was kind of an interesting story, and it runs about, I don't know, about 5 minutes or something. So I thought maybe the listeners might enjoy it.
All right. Well, let's listen to it right now.
Selling things is pretty simple, really. All you need is a good product at a good price and people will buy. At least that's the theory. When the product's a multi-million dollar business airplane, though, the process of connecting with customers is a bit different from trying to sell a Chevy or a BMW. Aircraft manufacturers tend to bring the airplane to the customers, although sometimes customers flock to see the airplane.
And there goes Bill Tiger to step in. Straga, six-time national championship winner.
This is Reno, home of the annual Reno Air Race. Each fall, crowds from around the world watch highly modified aircraft compete on a closed course where speeds within 100 feet of the ground can exceed 500 miles an hour. The aircraft are moving so fast, in fact, that it's often impossible to identify what just flew by. On the ground, though, between events, air shows like Reno can double as new airplane showrooms, where builders park new aircraft so buyers can get up close and personal. But with so much adrenaline already flowing at Reno, potential buyers want to see their jets in action. At this year's show, the Dassault Falcon demonstration team was only too happy to oblige by flying the Falcon 7X they'd brought with through a 10-minute routine in front of the crowd. P1 spoke to Falcon Jet's Teterboro chief pilot, Frank Onesi, who occupied the left seat of the 7X, and Falcon Jet captain Tom Morrison, who sat in the right. Both men are highly experienced aviators. We asked Frank Onesi first, why bother to bring a business jet to an air race?
There's a lot of exposure at Reno because of all the aviation enthusiasts that visit Reno every year for the air races. Directors, the flight departments, you have chief pilots, of course, and a lot of Falcon operators as well that show up for that event. So it was decided by management to, hey, let's bring an aircraft there. And it initially started possibly with just having the aircraft as a static for the audiences. And then eventually it turned into a demonstration. Each day, there was probably approximately 50,000 people that show up for the event. The product's being shown is its best. So that's a lot of exposure for a product.
And what made their routine so enticing to the audience?
During the air show routine, we're maxing out the performance of the airplane to show what it can do. The crowd loved it, and they found the performance of the airplane incredible. Even at the hotel, for instance, I had told Tom there was a couple that were having breakfast one morning, and they said, hey, are you guys the Falcon crew that flew that 7X? The show was spectacular.
But I wondered, how did the crew figure out exactly what they were going to do for their 10-minute slot?
Well, safety was paramount. One of our other former military pilots was doing this routine for a couple years, who was a former ex-Viper pilot in the Air Force, and he basically came up with the routine for us. So it was a combination of very high-performance takeoff, high-speed pass at 300-plus knots, and then we would continue with opposing passes on each opposite side of the runway, then followed by a slower pass with a wing rock to the audience, and then showing the very slow VREF capability of the airplane, followed by a high-performance landing. So Tommy modified it a little bit based on the terrain aspects of Reno. We kind of fine-tuned it with each additional run that we did at Reno each day, and it got better and better.
Of course, the Falcon 7X had a hand in the routine, and pilot Tom Morrison spoke to that.
The great features of the 7X, the fly-by-wire controls, is we didn't really have to worry about overgeeing the airplane. You know, we were pulling up pretty fast, and a couple times I hit the stops, and the airplane's not going to let you overgee it. It limits the flight control input so that the airplane was protecting itself against something stupid that we might do.
I also wondered how fast the airplane was moving when it was close to the ground. Frank Onesi explained.
We kind of came up with the 300 knot figure being, okay, it shows that the aircraft is pretty fast low to the ground, and it also gives enough time for the audience to see the airplane. So what we try to do is, on the high speed low passes, is just as we hit the 300 knot plus mark, we throttle back, and then the airplane goes by the audience super quiet.
I also wanted to hear some details about the landing at Reno.
We wanted to show the short field capability of the airplane, and so Tom and I always planned to try to get off midfield. I mean, the runway there at Reno is not the longest, but it's not the shortest, but we always planned to get off midfield, and that usually worked out because the grandstands are right at midfield. So we'd actually try to go a little bit long and then try to plan a very short landing and make the first turn off there at midfield at the runway.
Tom Morrison explained just a couple of those Falcon Jet pilot tricks that they used to close their demo at Reno this year.
When we turn off in front of the grandstand, point the nose of the airplane into the stands and flash the landing lights and rock the controls back and forth, we couldn't hear it, but it looked like there was a lot of cheering going on. They were waving their hats and flags and everything. Everybody gets very excited to see that.
Of course, no audio show ever does justice to an air show. And in case you were wondering what this Falcon 7X routine looked like, we've put a link to a Dassault-created video right here on the web. For P1 at the Reno Air Races, I'm Rob Mark.
Wow, Rob, nice report. You're kind of a content-producing machine these days with that and On the Mark and everything else you're doing.
Well, you know, it's really funny, but of course, as most people know, I spent 15 years writing with another business aviation publication and a few others, but these two companies between P1 and the Cygnus folks, aviationpros.com, they've really given me a chance to go out and try some new things between audio and video. And what I realized is I really like this. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah, it is. It is. I'm looking at the P1 site. You mentioned that P1-mag.com, which I don't think I'd been here before. The number one rated business aviation magazine.
Yeah, and when they first approached me, I said, oh, that's interesting. And the fellow that owns the place, Sam, said, you've never seen it before, have you? No, I don't even know what you're talking about. but it is pretty cool. So I'd invite everybody. You know, it's a freebie. It's business aviation focused, but there's a lot of cool stuff going on there. I'd invite everybody to go take a look and see what they think.
Rick, have you ever been to Reno or any other air races?
No, I haven't, and it's something that I really want to do, and I've been meaning to go. It's happened that I either have the days, and I'm sitting on reserve, and I can't move out of Miami, or I just don't have the days available to, you know, head out there and actually go to one of these events, because I do have to request my time off a month in advance. And so, you know, and it still is a bid type system. And so sometimes, you know, I'm outbid. So, it's a little tricky sometimes, but I would love to head out there and check one of those, events out. It'd be great.
Yeah. Definitely on the bucket list, I think, for all
absolutely.
Of us. Yeah.
And Rick, it definitely seems like Rob's raising the bar for us at Farnborough.
I tell you.
Sheesh.
Yeah.
Farnborough.
Well, all you've got to do is ask. It's too bad we don't know anybody in Britain we could ask about this kind of pronunciation conundrum. Maybe we'll meet somebody someday.
Yeah. You know, we had a speaking of pronunciation, we had a quite an email exchange with one of our listeners about the pronunciation of Qatar. That went back and forth in a couple of different sideways directions. But sometimes these pronunciation issues are tough.
Yes, we decided it was Qatar, not Qatar.
I did.
Okay.
But the
answer is the Pentagon calls it Qatar, so I'm going to call it Qatar.
Yeah. All right. Well, we need to, I think, bring this one to a close. But before we do, just one quick mention. Ryan Hothersall sent in a Flickr album from the Jamestown Air Show. He says that David had mentioned the TBM Avenger, and he'd got some photos in this Flickr album that we'll put a link to in the show notes. He also says that he flew on an AN-2 the day before the show, and he's got sort of a trip report of that. We'll put that link in the show notes as well. So with that, we want to thank our guests. First, Skuli Mogensen, the CEO of WOW Air, really interesting guy. We had a great conversation with him. As you know, our preference is to have guests on live, but sometimes schedules just don't allow it.
He was live when we recorded him.
And enjoying his holiday in Florida. Of course, we also want to thank Miami Rick from the Airline Pilot Guy podcast. Rick, again, tell our listeners where they can find that show and find you on Twitter and so forth.
So it's at @Miami_Rick, and the website is airlinepilotguy.com. And I want to thank all of you guys for having me on. It's been great. I had a blast, and I hope to have you guys on our show sometime very, very soon.
Ah, we'd love to. And also, yeah, we really enjoyed having you on the show. I think we only just started to tap into the knowledge that you can bring concerning the plane you fly, the experiences you've had, and so maybe we can catch up again in the future and do that. And of course, it was great to meet you at the Udvar Hazy Center event this past June when we met you and Pilot Jeff and Dr. Steph. That was a real blast too.
It was great. It was great to meet you guys. And hey, Max, anytime you want to do this again, you know, just let me know, and I'd be honored. It'd be great.
That's great. Fantastic. All right. Well, let's tell our listeners where they can find all of the rest of us online. We'll start with David Vanderhoof.
You can find me on Twitter as DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/airplanegeeks. And, of course, you can find me on that other show, UAV Digest, with Max Flight on Fridays at theuavdigest.com.
Great. And Max Trescott, how about you?
Oh, I think I'll mention my flight training site. Go ahead and go to SJ, short for San Jose, flight.com. And if you're in the San Francisco Bay Area and want to fly in a Cirrus or Modern Glass cockpit aircraft, give me a call.
Great. And how about you, Rob Mark?
Well, let's see. I don't know. Jetwine on a bunch of places, Twitter, Facebook, the blog, jetwine.com. Find me wandering around at P1 Magazine, and also the new On the Mark show, and also at AOPA Pilot, the turbine section.
Boy, Rob, you're everywhere. Fantastic. Let's see. Brian Coleman, how about you?
Well, this Thursday, you'll be able to find me at LAX with my tin cup. Begging for money to get over to Farnborough on my way to Hamburg. So the email's the best way to get a hold of me, and it's brian@airplanegeeks.com.
Cool. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Twitter as Max Flight. Same on LinkedIn. As David mentioned, the UAVDigest.com. You can also find me on the PaxXPodcast.com that I do with Mary Kirby. You can find us, of course, at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/379. We're on all the usual social media places. Find us on Twitter, Facebook. We have a Google Plus community. You can also find us on Stitcher.com and TuneIn Radio. If you'd like to subscribe to this podcast so it comes to you automatically, we encourage you to do that. You can do that on iTunes, or if you have an Android device, just your favorite podcast app. If you want to send us an email, that's thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Fly safely.
Thanks for listening.
Keep the blue side up.
I can tell you, Brian was talking about going to I believe the Brits call it Farnborough, and we've been discussing what the correct pronunciation of that particular word is.
It's like potable, and, you know. You
no, it's potable it's potable and pitot.
Hey Rick, before you go, we asked Dr. Steph this question, so we have to ask you. Now that you've been on the show, who do you like better, us or Captain Jeff?
Yeah, we did ask her that, or somebody did. Probably Brian.
No, I think it was actually Rob.
Oh. But then there's our song, you know, that one that goes, our show's better than your show. Our show's better than yours.
But they
sing can, it, guys.
But they can. They could also sing. Our show's longer than your show. Our show's longer than yours.